For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Governor Fallon decided late Friday afternoon to sign and veto a big chunk of the bills on her desk, and many of them upset a lot of people. Let's start with the veto of the bill allowing anyone over the age of 21 to carry a gun without a permit. Neva, this upset a lot of Second Amendment advocates. Were you surprised?
Well, I think it upset some folks, but I think what we saw was it was such a fatally flawed bill that you had all of these groups. I mean, even folks that are strong Second Amendment folks saying this is a bad piece of legislation. I mean, if we want to do something, we need to come back to the table with something that doesn't have all of the problems that were clearly delineated during the course of, you know, back and forth advocating for the governor to do exactly what she did. So was it a big surprise? I don't think so, really, at the end. I think a lot of people probably, particularly in the business community and others, were relieved to see the governor take this position and not just default to what would have been typically a much easier role of just saying this is a Second Amendment bill and I'm going to sign it. So it was a mixed bag, clearly.
Ryan.
And if you can't veto this gun bill, there's no gun bill that you can veto. Mm-hmm. I mean, this bill had problems, as Neva said. You had business groups lined up against it, OSBI, public safety, law enforcement lined up against it. Not only did you have law enforcement lining up against it, saying that this, you know, increases the danger to the public and danger to law enforcement officers, there is a huge fiscal impact to OSBI and their ability to operate. So, you know, this was, you know, you had everything from a budget hit to a public safety hit. Everybody was lined up against this, except Republican gubernatorial candidates. And, you know, interesting turn of events. You've got, and what we've seen, kind of the most interesting of all of this is former Mayor Cornett. You know, he's really moved further and further to the right in this Republican primary contest, and somebody who, you know, maybe as mayor would have come out against this piece of legislation and said permitless carry is bad for Oklahoma, it's bad for Oklahoma City. Now, as a Republican gubernatorial candidate, he joined all other Republican gubernatorial candidates saying that they would have signed this piece of legislation. And that kind of tells you what that Republican primary looks like right now.
Well, and what it tells you is it is a Republican primary where the emphasis is on the most conservative voting bloc within the Republican Party. These are the folks that come out in primary elections. These are older voters. These are people that the issues like the constitutional issues, the Second Amendment issues are very important to them. So that part was not really a surprise. I think people see the politics taking shape in that, as we always do in any political contest, particularly one this spirited.
Why veto it and not just let it pocket veto? That way you don't even have to put your name to it.
Well, I think the interesting question. I think clearly the governor made a decision that, as we both said, was a bad piece of legislation and outlined why. And I think it lent support to public safety, to a lot of these folks that are in law enforcement and elsewhere, that look, we do see when something like this comes to my desk, I mean, it is something that that warrants action, and the action in this instance was a veto.
LGBTQ advocates say they're disappointed but not surprised by Fallon's signing a bill allowing adoption groups to deny prospective parents based on religious views. Ryan, was your reaction to disappointed but not surprised?
Disappointed but not surprised, and extremely disappointed. I think, you know, there are three parts to this. First, the people that this hurts the most, and that's kids. You know, children, they don't have a choice of adoption agencies. They don't get to move to other states. They don't get to go to different jurisdictions. They're right here in Oklahoma. They need families. Thousands of kids need families. Hard to place kids need families. And that we would restrict that on these discriminatory grounds is just a real slap in the face to those kids. Two, if we look at the folks behind this, there's this disturbing cognitive dissonance. You know, one of the largest backers of this was the Catholic Diocese, and they've used an enormous part of their political muscle over the years to curb women's reproductive rights. They've gone to the Capitol and made it harder for women to terminate pregnancies legally and safely in the state of Oklahoma. And now, on the other hand, they're making it harder for people to adopt out children in the state of Oklahoma. That's just, it's very shameful. And then finally, with the governor, to me, what this is I think it's just casual indifference to bigotry. I don't think that this is because the governor's a bigot or anything like that, or that she wants to discriminate. I think that she's just kind of lazy. I don't think that she really cares about this issue all that much, and she found it easier to throw some table scraps to fanatics than to really stand up and take a stand on this piece of legislation.
Neither.
Well, there was clearly a difference of opinion on whether organizations, based on their religious beliefs, of how they should be able to deal with the question of adoption. It wasn't blanket across all adoptions, all agencies, and clearly, I mean, this was an issue that had a lot of traction, with voters across the board. So there was a difference of opinion, but let's make no mistake, there were two sides to this argument, and I think the governor came down on the side of where the vast majority of the people in her party in particular probably would be in agreement.
Freedom Oklahoma says they're going to possibly bring up a lawsuit. Do you think that they've got a case here?
I think litigation options are on the table, and we've seen litigation in other states. You know, my sense is that, you know, when this bill becomes effective November 1, the moment somebody is denied the opportunity to participate in an adoption because they are in a same-sex relationship or in a same-sex marriage or because they're gay or lesbian or because they're divorced or any other thing that some religious organization wants to impose as they want to hide behind this idea of religious liberty, when it's not religious liberty to discriminate. That's not the right that you've got in this country. If they want to do that and accept public funding to do that, there's going to be litigation, and I think that it'll be successful.
Now, why do you think that she made this announcement on Friday evening and not,
she wanted to,
Well, basically, I mean, it was after 5 o'clock on a Friday.
It definitely
was a calculated move on her part, but not a surprising one. I mean, I think everyone expected that it probably was going to go to the end of the week. She was going to start signing bills, vetoing bills, kind of getting them off her desk. And so the only question was, how many surprises would there be? And in this instance, I think she just chose this kind of path of least resistance to get her job done and get the paperwork off her desk.
You drop bad unpopular news on Fridays at 5 o'clock. That's a political rule that goes back as old as politics and the media.
Exactly. Now, critics on both sides of the aisle are raising concerns about a 9-member committee appointed by GOP leadership, which is deciding how agencies should spend their money and which services to provide. Lawmakers allocated $2 million for a private firm to conduct audits overseen by the members. Ryan, your thoughts on the Agency Performance and Accountability Commission?
I think it's likely unconstitutional. I think that in our state constitution, I think that the legislature can't delegate away their legislative authority like this, because one of the things that this says is that this commission, they review these audits, which are going to cost millions of dollars. I mean, they gave $2 million to it right now. That doesn't even cover all of the state agencies. But even after they cover these audits, this agency, this unelected, unaccountable agency, the recommendations that they make to these agencies are binding. You know, they're using legislative authority to bind decision-making in these agencies in a way that I think violates both the legislative authority provisions of our state constitution and the checks and balances provision of our constitution. Kudos to Oklahoma Watch, who broke this story.
Yeah.
I mean, this is huge. Huge abdication of responsibility in the legislature and the way that we're governing our state agencies. You know, and this has opposition on both sides of the aisle. You have Democrats that are against it. You know, Gary Jones, Republican gubernatorial candidate, current state auditor and inspector, has said that they could do these audits for a heck of a lot cheaper and do them in a way that's that understands the way that state agencies work. If you look at the people on this commission, they don't understand how state agencies work. You know, very few of them have any in-depth knowledge of the state of Oklahoma and how government works.
Right. Neva.
Well, I think when you talk about auditing these state agencies, letting the auditor and inspector do those things, yes, that's already been going on. But let's face it. I mean, we've done such a good job of figuring out what's going on in these agencies with the money that's being spent that we had the debacle this year with the state health department. I mean, not just a few million dollars as it started out. Now we're into numbers that range up to $100 million. So, I mean, I think from looking at it, stepping back from the taxpayer perspective, you know, and pile on the business community, everyone wants to say that this is just some, you know, measure to give them more power and control in the process. I think what it says is that people want to see a more in-depth, a more serious look at what's going on in state government, where the money's being spent, where there is waste, where there's fraud, where there's mismanagement, and make recommendations. Are these recommendations binding at this point on this commission? Yes, but I think to say that this group of nine people don't have the integrity or the ability to do what they've been charged to do in a voluntary capacity. These are unpaid individuals that are stepping forward in true public service to try to accomplish the job set before them. I think let's give them a chance. I mean, what problem is there? The legislature is still going to be involved in the appropriations process. Yes, you have three people making the decision who those nine members are, but at the end of the day, someone has to make the decision on everything. And so I think it moves us more toward accountability and certainly gives us an opportunity year in and year out to see these agencies under the microscope and have these folks be able to really explain A, what they're doing, and B, where their needs are. And I think when they can make a compelling case, they may find some of the best advocates for them on the outside to help get some of the money that's long been needed in places like corrections and other places.
I think what we're going to find is that these agencies just don't have the money to do what they're charged to do to begin with. And if these nine folks want to, if they want to have a say in the way our government operates, run for office to have the luxury of being able to serve voluntarily without any sort of pay or compensation and be able to sit in judgment of state agencies and make binding recommendations about the way the state of Oklahoma works. If you want to do that, that's fine, but there should be some accountability there, and it shouldn't be so attenuated that there are, that there's a layer of a speaker or a pro temp or the governor in between you and these decision makers. If you're going to be a decision maker in the state of Oklahoma, there ought to be some accountability to the people. And right now, there's just really none in the state.
But how do you say that and then have the state, then you have state regents for higher education, you have regents at all of these universities who are in that same basic position, public servants being appointed by the governor, being confirmed by the Senate, that are in the role of really deciding how the dollars are going to be spent, what's going to happen in major multi-million dollar budgets in that instance. So I think when you look, when you start looking across the board, we already have some of that. What we're saying is that this is another opportunity to try this, and frankly, we're not in a place where we can say we've done a good job of figuring out how government's working, where the dollars are going, and until we can, I think we need to give this an opportunity to see what they really can step up and do.
Well, I think the other concern is that there's a duplication of services, paying a private firm to do audits when you've got an actual state
auditor. There's duplication of services. I mean,
well, that's what I'm saying. It's usually an argument that most people say is we don't want to duplicate services, but here is actual evidence of a duplication of services.
Absolutely, and I think in this instance, there's a very specific opportunity for some outside independent group, and in this case, audits, to come in and see what they can do in a very time sensitive fashion. So, I mean, the folks that take these contracts when they're let, I mean, they have a very high threshold, I think, in terms of scrutiny that they're going to be under. So, I mean, it's kind of it can either be a win-win situation for us or a lose-lose, and I choose to believe that we need to give it an opportunity to be a win-win.
The first form of waste that they should find here is exactly what you're talking about, Michael, is the duplication of services. The difference between this and the state regents or some other even uncompensated members of commissions in the state of Oklahoma is that they
which
are already
virtually
there.
All of them.
And we're putting just another layer of government on top of that. I love that we're in the Republican era of government in the state of Oklahoma, and what we've done is we've duplicated services that have already existed and created more government with this in a way that is going to spend millions of dollars, and at the end of the day, we end up with just some political talking points, and the legislature now in a position where they're going to have to fight over the politics that come out of this commission, over whether they overrule the binding recommendations that they make to these agencies.
A teachers union is challenging the initiative petition designed to stop the tax increases, which will pay for raises to teachers, school support staff, and state workers. According to Professional Oklahoma Educators, or POE, the petition by Oklahoma Taxpayers Unite, which is supported by former Senator Tom Coburn, is unconstitutional. Neva, how much does this change the game here?
Well, it may change it substantially. I mean, this is kind of a new twist, and I think when you look at the legal opinions that have been offered on this and where they're kind of coming down, I mean, it sets an interesting question, and I think it does. I mean, there are now even more questions than answers, and I mean, Ryan, from a legal perspective, perspective may have a different slant on it. But just at first blush, I would say, I mean, these folks have a legitimate case that they're putting forward from a legal perspective, and we'll have to see how it plays out.
Ryan, what is their case here?
Yeah, well, their case is under Article 5, Section 2 of the Oklahoma Constitution, is that the referendum, you know, the ability of the people of Oklahoma to go to the voters and go back to the voters and overturn some action of the legislature. It's a very powerful, very populist, very progressive tool that Oklahomans have under their state constitution. It's rarely used, but in the instance that it is used, the only time that the law is allowed to continue to move forward in that instance, you know, prior to the referendum being voted on, is whenever there is a law necessary for the immediate preservation of public peace, health, or safety. And so that's what a court's going to have to look at here. They're going to have to make this determination. Now, what does immediate health, peace, or public health and safety, what does that mean? You know, well, a court's going to have to decide whether or not these revenue-raising measures and the education that the education funding that they're going to, primarily salary increases for teachers and support staff, whether or not that meets that rare exception there. Now, if it does not, it still could delay things. And, you know, I think that what this shows is whether it's APOE or OEA, whomever it is, at some point, there's going to be litigation at every step. There's going to be a challenge to this referendum process every step of the way. And I suspect that we'll probably see a challenge on signatures. That, to me, is probably the more fruitful challenge here, if for no other reason that it just takes a lot
quicker.
Of time.
Yeah.
And so if you challenge those signatures, you got to verify them, you could just run out of time.
Yeah, I was going to say, does it pause the time at all, or does the time still sometime in July 12th or something like that, they have to get this done?
My sense is that they still have to get this done by the deadline that was initially given to them by the Secretary of State.
Even if there's
a
challenge.
Which I think is July 18th for
July
the 41,000 signatures.
Yeah, that deadline still is in effect. And so if you're out collecting those signatures, you've got to collect those signatures as if you were going to succeed in this court challenge.
Yeah, so there's still teachers and there's still schools. You've got the state superintendent going to the AG saying, what about pay raises? Can we move forward with
That's a legitimate question. Mm-hmm. And if you're the State Department of Education and you're trying to decide, do we increase salaries right now? Do we pay the budgets in accordance with the budget that the legislature gave us?
Right.
Or do we pay it in accordance with where we would be with if this referendum on the revenue raising measures passes? Because the salary increases are all contingent upon these revenue raising measures. And so you take those away, then the salary increases go away. And I think that's a legit question for the Department of Education right
Neva.
Now.
Oh, absolutely. I think I think there are so many questions now. And will this impact really the voters out there as they're looking at, do they want to sign this petition? What does this petition really mean? What is it going to do in terms of impacting their kids, the schools, the teachers?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it becomes kind of a slippery slope. And it's fascinating. We are one of 24 states that do have, you know, the referendum, but we also have a history of, not passing these as well. I mean, 1954 is a long time ago when the last one, I believe, was passed in Oklahoma. So.
Yeah, and also, of course, teachers, they're not able to sign. A lot of the lawyers have said don't do contracts or with the extra pay. And so they're looking at this going, well, then Texas is still looking pretty darn good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and even with the salary increases, it's not like we've solved all of our problems. We still have a huge deficit in the number of dollars that are going into classrooms compared to where we were a decade ago. Especially if you account for the enormous increase in class sizes that we have from a decade ago. So we have fewer dollars and more students. And even though this was a big step in the right direction, it still doesn't get us there. So if this is on pause, then, you know, all bets are off.
Yeah,
I think that we're going to continue to hemorrhage teachers.
And although it moved us up to like 31st or 32nd in teacher pay, now you have all these other states in the area who are raising their teacher pay. So we're going to hit back to 49th, 50th, if, you know, especially if this doesn't go through.
I love this race, though. This is a good problem for education to have, where we've got states finally waking up to the fact that if we want to invest in education, that one of the things that we have to do is to invest in educators.
The Oklahoma Ethics Commission is suing the state over its appropriation. While the agency requested $4.5 million to do its job of holding elected officials accountable, the legislature actually gave it $710,000. Ryan, does the commission have a case here?
Absolutely. The Ethics Commission is a constitutionally created organization. They're not created by the legislature. They are created by a vote of the people. They are a constitutional organization. And part of the question that voters approved that created the Ethics Commission says that they shall receive the appropriate amount of funding and dollars to adequately do their job. And what they're saying right now is that even with the appropriation that they've been receiving, that's still not enough to do their job. And so this $4 million that they increased, the four and a half that they requested, they got $710,000. And that was basically just, you know, their
sweeping the revolving fund.
That was their revolving fund. That was just the money that they kind of had in savings to operate on from month to month. And so $710,000 out of a $4.5 million request, and they're still not able to do the job that they need to do. This is an organization that, if fully funded and fully functional, is really the watchdog for the people of Oklahoma, so that we talk about integrity, so that when we look at our elections and we look at, you know, why lawmakers are casting the votes that they're casting, that we can look at that and at least have transparency, if not integrity, but hopefully both.
Neva.
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, this has been a commission that's basically been at war off and on with the legislature from 1990,
since
it was created. And the question of the needed appropriated budget, what they need to do their job. I mean, that's the rub. I mean, the legislators looking at it have one point of view. I mean, that they don't need the escalation in terms of staff and a lot of the other things that the commission has sought to do. And the flip side, the commission says this is our role, this is what we need, this is what we want, and there's the rub. And I think we're going to see this fight continue. Unfortunately, I think it is a bad place when you have commissions like this put themselves at a place where they want to sue, you know, whomever. I mean, the folks yet to be named in this lawsuit. So, but the fact that they made this decision, the board voted on it, and they're moving forward, it remains to be seen what the long-term fallout is. But again, it does pose unintended consequences on the folks that, you know, are out there running as candidates, having to, you know, having to file constantly, trying to be kept abreast of any changes that are going on, and all of the, you know, kind of all of the ancillary things that surround that. So, it is a problem. And what I don't think anyone wants to see is to see an agency move down a road that becomes so punitive and so overreaching that it becomes what many think the FEC at the federal level in elections have become. I mean, a major bureaucracy more than just a commission with oversight in how they're functioning and doing their jobs.
Lee Slater, who ran the Ethics Commission for a bit and is one of the, you know, the preeminent ethics lawyers in the state of Oklahoma, whenever he was the commissioner there, one of the things that he said was that he wanted to turn the Ethics Commission into a commission that focused more on compliance than on punitive measures. And I think that that's important, because if we have compliance, what that gives us is transparency. The role of the Ethics Commission isn't to go out and be heavy-handed, punish people, prosecute people. The goal is really so that the people of Oklahoma have a window into the potential influences and conflicts of interest that may exist with their decision makers at the statewide level and at the state legislative level. And this comes back, Article 29, Section 2 of the state constitution says that the Ethics Commission shall receive an annual appropriation by the legislature sufficient to enable it to perform its duties as set forth in this constitutional amendment. And that's going to be what the court's going to have to look at. They're going to have to look at what is sufficient and what's necessary. And we exist at a time right now where not only candidates are having a hard time keeping up with all of the new filings and making sure that they're compliant, but you have independent expenditure organizations, you have nonprofit groups, you have non-candidate campaigns that are operating in the state. And in the post-Citizens United world, campaign and ethics laws are the most complex they have ever been in our nation's history and in our state's history. So it's important that we have a robust and functioning ethics commission. Now, does that mean $4.5 million or $700,000? You know, it may be somewhere in between, but that's what a court's going to have to examine.
And the Ethics Commission, of course, is also itself having to keep track of everything that's going on nationally and state, so they can actually keep up with it. And they don't, if they've got, don't have enough people to hire, then it makes it harder for them to do their job.
Yeah.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.